We hebben een gast in de studio. We have a guest in our studio. He's sitting right opposite me, and that's David Cronin. So, David Cronin, you're a journalist, and you're not from here. You're from Ireland?
I'm from Ireland, yeah, Dublin, Ireland, yeah.
Okay, but you've been living in Brussels for quite a while, apparently.
I've been living in Brussels since 1995, so last month I celebrated, if that's the right word, 19 years in Brussels.
Okay, and you've always been working in Brussels as a journalist?
No, I actually came to Brussels originally because I was offered a job in the European Parliament, working for one of the Green members of the European Parliament at that time. So I found that a very, very stressful job. Somehow I managed to do it for 3 years. But since then, I've been working full-time as a journalist in Brussels.
And what media do you work for then?
I freelance, but for the last few years, I've been doing a lot of work on Palestine. So the main thing that keeps me busy is that I'm an editor, one of the editors of a website called the Electronic Intifada, which, as its name suggests, is very much focused on Palestine and on Israel's human rights abuses.
Mm-hmm. But your last book is about something else.
That's right. I have written a book on Israel's relationship with the European Union, which was published towards the end of 2010. But my most recent book is called Corporate Europe, and it examines the influence of big business over European Union decision-making.
Okay, we hear a lot about that over the last years. It's becoming quite obvious that this influence is quite strong.
Absolutely, and it's growing. I think one manifestation of that is next week, the fourth round of negotiations aimed at achieving a trade and investment agreement between Europe and the United States are scheduled to take place. This, in my opinion, is one of the most worrying developments, for want of a better word, that have taken place in some time. Of course, Karel de Gucht, who is a former Belgian foreign minister and is now the European Union Trade Commissioner, is presenting the agenda that he is pushing with the United States as being beneficial to ordinary people. He's making all kinds of claims about how many jobs will be created and how richer all of us will become. But when you actually examine the nitty-gritty of what is being discussed, it's almost impossible not to conclude that there's a deliberate attempt being made here to hand over responsibility for public policy to corporations. Of course, there are people who will accuse me of scaremongering in saying this, but I don't believe that that's the case. Perhaps the most troubling proposal that's on the table at the moment is that this agreement would lead to the establishment of a specialised court, or a tribunal, as it is being described. And this court would be reserved for corporations. It would allow corporations to sue public administrations over pretty much any policy, any legislation, any policy that they regard as harmful to their bottom line. And they can demand compensation for any losses that they believe they have incurred because of particular laws that have been introduced.
So if there are laws that are supposed to protect the population against the harmful effects of corporations, then those don't count?
They can be challenged, yep. And we can look at the history of these kind of tribunals. Many of them have been set up in the past under so-called bilateral investment treaties. Mm-hmm. And what they've led to is a whole raft of litigation by, for example, the tobacco industry. Indeed, the tobacco industry is something of a pioneer in this respect. In Uruguay, for example, in South America, efforts have been made to introduce quite strict anti-smoking legislation, and Philip Morris has taken legal action against the Uruguayan authority over this legislation. Or closer to home, in Germany, following the nuclear accident in Japan, Fukushima, in 2011, if I'm not mistaken, there was a decision made by Germany to get out of nuclear power. And Vattenfall, the very big Swedish energy corporation, has decided to demand compensation from Germany under a thing called the Energy Charter Treaty. alleging that it's going to incur enormous losses because of this decision and is demanding, I can't remember the exact figure, but is demanding billions, I think, in compensation from the German authorities over this decision. So basically, this is, you know, the decision about what kind of energy a country should have is really a question of national sovereignty. It's something that the people of any country should have a say in. It's of fundamental importance in terms of their health and safety and the protection of the environment and so on. But with this kind of agenda that Carol de Gucht is promoting at the moment, corporations would be given carte blanche to threaten basically governments over anything that they consider to be harmful to the maximisation of profits.
But, I mean, have there been no cases then where the population is protesting against it? Like in Uruguay, for example.
Even in Germany, this is a clear example of something that the population wants. You know, that there's been a vibrant anti-nuclear movement in Germany for decades. This was a sovereign decision that was taken by the German authorities, yet it's under threat simply because a major corporation, a very powerful corporation, doesn't like it. You know, when we talk about courts and so on, there's normally the idea, at least in theory, there's the idea that everybody's equal before a court and, you know, there's at least international agreements and so on about international practice and customs on fair trials, for example. But in this case, we're not talking about having judges that can be considered. It's obviously it's questionable whether judges are really impartial in any event, but in this case they certainly would not be impartial or independent judges. What we're talking about, the people who would actually handle these cases would be corporate lawyers. For example, one idea that's being examined is that they could come from the International Chamber of Commerce in Paris. The International Chamber of Commerce in Paris is just a lobbying organisation for big business. And one thing that's particularly significant is that, you know, just in the last couple of weeks, there is a decision taken at European Union level about tobacco products and so on, and about the requirement that from now on, most of the packaging for cigarette boxes will be plain packaging, you know, and under the final shape of the agreement, 65% of a cigarette box will be devoted to health warnings. The original idea that was under discussion by the European Commission was that 100% of a cigarette box would be devoted to health warnings. But the International Chamber of Commerce in Paris threatened the Commission over this, saying that this would violate intellectual property legislation and so on, and intellectual property standards. The European Commission caved into pressure from bodies like the International Chamber of Commerce. So it's quite frightening that, you know, a body that is essentially able to, you know, twist the arms of supposedly powerful politicians is being presented as a suitable body to assess cases of fundamental importance to the health and well-being of all of us.
Now, this is one example. I mean, there is some legislation on the table and then it is hindered by corporate institutions. But isn't there influence of the corporate world even in an earlier stage?
There's an influence. The corporations have an involvement in every stage of European Union legislation. One thing that has kind of proliferated in recent years is the fact that many pieces of legislation are effectively drawn up by corporations. The European Commission, the EU's executive branch, has set up a whole array of what it calls expert groups, in inverted commas. That sounds very technical and so on, but if you look at the composition of these expert groups, who actually prepare the blueprint for many laws and policies, they are in many cases dominated by corporations. And we're talking about everything, you know, everything from fertilizers to car emissions, you know, and these guys just set the whole agenda. What's particularly problematic in many cases is the fact that in many cases that there are very clear conflict of interest involved. For example, the European Union's new scientific research programme, which has a budget, I think, of something like 80 billion euros, a huge amount of money, came into effect at the beginning of this year. It runs between this year and the end of the decade.
A seven-year programme, isn't it?
It's a seven-year programme, yeah. And what has actually happened in that case is that many of the companies who actually decided on and made recommendations about what the core priorities of this programme should be are exactly the same companies who will be able to apply for the subsidies that are on offer from this programme. In my view, that's a very clear conflict of interest. Yes. But the European Commission just won't accept the fact that that is a conflict of interest.
You'll say it should come to us.
Well, of course, yeah.
Well, they don't say it so overtly, but...
Yeah, exactly. And of course, I know we're going to have elections to the European Parliament in May of this year. The European Parliament, unfortunately, is just as amenable to corporate pressure as the, if not more so, than the non-elected institutions of the European Union.
It shouldn't be. I mean...
Of course it shouldn't be. Of course it shouldn't
be. Those people at least should be, well, elected by us, so defending the interests of the population.
Of course. That is how democracy is supposed to work. If you're of a sadistic nature and you want to find a large number of corporate lobbyists, the best place to go on any day of the week is the European Parliament in Brussels, because there's just kind of multitudes of corporate lobbyists there on any given day. You know, a very clear example of that is following the financial crisis, which erupted in 2008, there was kind of an acceptance that hedge funds and these other kind of exotic investment funds had a large part to play in creating that crisis. And, there was a realisation that some effort had to be made to regulate these funds. So what happened was that then, you know, the European Commission came forward with a actually fairly weak proposal about regulating hedge funds. And immediately, as soon as a copy of it was sent to the European Parliament, very powerful people in the City of London, which is one of the main centres for hedge funds in the world, hopped on the Eurostar train, came over to Brussels and started bombarding the members of the European Parliament with proposals to change aspects of this law that they didn't like. And what actually happened was that many of the more influential members of the European Parliament, and some of them admitted to me openly that this is what they did, they actually just copied and pasted the amendments that were prepared by the hedge fund industry and tabled them and signed them in their own name.
Why?
Well, some members of the European Parliament are actually former hedge fund...
So that's the revolving door.
Yeah. And, you know, it's just accepted. I mean, many MEPs will actually say that they believe that their job is to stand up for the industry in their home country. Okay, that in itself, there's nothing particularly wrong or pernicious with that. But when it's taken to such an extent, when it's stretched to such an extent that these MEPs favour the maximisation of profits over all other considerations, when it comes to such an extent that legislation that affects you and I, that affects all of us, and in this case, the case of hedge fund regulation, actually, you know, affects the entire economy, when this legislation is shaped in such a way that it only benefits a tiny elite and is actually very harmful, or potentially very harmful to 99.9% of the rest of the population, that is fundamentally dangerous and fundamentally anti-democratic.
Mm-hmm. What do you think can be done about it?
I think, okay, in the short term, the election that's happening in May is important. Of course, I would encourage people to turn it into a kind of a referendum on the austerity policies and on the trade policies, for example, that the European Union is pushing, and to vote and elect candidates that have been outspoken against the austerity policies and against the trade policies that the European Union is pursuing. But I don't think that that's sufficient. The European Union is fundamentally anti-democratic, mm-hmm. and an election to the European Parliament is not going to change that in any serious way. What we need to do, what we really need to concentrate on, is building a mass movement that challenges the whole agenda of the European Union. I'm quite optimistic. I think the anti-austerity policies that we've seen in Greece, Spain, Italy, in parts of Eastern Europe, like Romania, over recent years, are something that can be built on. What there needs to be, and this is happening to a certain extent, but I think there needs to be more effort made to kind of join up movements in different countries, yes. You know.
But I think people only join when they feel it really in their own lives, and people in Spain and Greece will feel it, but here people don't really feel it very hard yet.
Sure, yeah, but I'm encouraged all the same. Late last year, I took part in protests that were organised by an alliance called the D1920 Alliance, and that brought together many quite a diverse range of different groups. Interestingly enough, the protests were originally sought by the dairy farmers, one of the dairy farmers' organizations.
Yes, and we did an interview about it, and it became very broad.
Exactly. It's got some support from the trade union movement and from the anti-poverty movement. It hasn't got kind of 100% support yet from the trade union movement, so there's still work to do in that regard. But I think that's very encouraging. Those protests were quite well attended. It could have been bigger, perhaps, but they were a good start. You know, they got people out, and they got the day in which it took place. It began early in the morning. It wasn't a very nice morning or anything like that. It was just a week before Christmas, and but people came out very early in the morning, very determined, very good-humoured. And it definitely made an impact. Of course, it didn't stop the summit from going ahead. And that summit was a particularly disgusting one in many ways, because there was a decision made during it to support the development of the European arms industry, and particularly to invest more in drones, these sophisticated killing machines.
I remember that on that same day there was an action by Vredesactie, against the influence of the corporate world on the European policy regarding arm trade.
Yeah, I took part in one of those actions. I think this is something that requires a lot more work and a lot more investigation. And this is something that brings together the work that I've been doing on Palestine quite closely to the work that I've been doing in the last couple of years on corporate power. What's particularly troubling is that the European Union has established a program known as the Security Research Program. It was established as a response to the September the 11th atrocities in 2001. And officially this is being presented as a kind of a civilian research program. But if you look at who the recipients of the money, and there's a lot of money involved, I think it was about 1.4 billion euros between 2007 and 2013, and that's almost certainly going to increase now over the next few years. Israel has been very much involved in this program, and exactly the same companies that have manufactured the drones that were used to kill innocent men, women and children in Gaza in 2008 and 2009, and more recently with the shorter attack in 2012, have benefited very handsomely from this program. And indeed, some of the projects that have been financed are to do with the use of drone technology or surveillance technology that has been tested against Palestinian civilians. There's a deliberate attempt being made to use this technology here in Europe. That's extremely disturbing. And again, this comes back to what I was saying earlier. The whole kind of agenda for this programme was drawn up by the arms industry.
Yes, they say there is a problem and we have the solution.
Exactly.
So they define the problem and they...
Oh, this happens all the time. If you recall, I think in the autumn of last year, a few hundred Africans drowned very tragically off the coast of Lampedusa, the Italian island. Immediately, as soon as this appalling tragedy occurred, the European Commission said, we need to respond to this by using drones for border surveillance. And, of course, what they're claiming is that these war machines can save lives and they can be used to rescue asylum seekers who might be in danger of drowning in future. But if you actually look at what's really behind these proposals, it's not about rescue. It's not about rescuing asylum seekers. It's not about saving lives. It's actually about intercepting these boats before they actually reach Europe's shores and stopping very poor people from reaching Europe. So it's actually a fundamentally a racist, anti-poor policy that is being implemented with the help of the European arms industry. And of course, the European arms industry stands to benefit enormously from the sale of this technology. Again, it's a case of a very clear conflict of interests.
Mm-hmm. Okay, our time is up. So everybody who wants to hear more about this can see you here in Antwerp in a few days, I think.
That's right, on Tuesday.
So you will be telling more about the content of your book.
Yeah, exactly.
And maybe also a bit more on what we are going to do about this.
Exactly, yeah.
Anything you wanted to add?
Yeah, well, given that I'm here in Antwerp, I think it's very important. Obviously, Antwerp is one of the most important centres of the diamond trade in the world. Last summer, actually, I did a little bit of an investigation on the links between Israel and Antwerp, and I wasn't surprised, but I was quite shocked by the fact that there are a number of companies in the Antwerp Diamond District that are offering express delivery from Tel Aviv to Antwerp on a daily basis. These include G4S, the security company, which is also involved in running prisons for Israel in the occupied West Bank. Diamonds are of fundamental importance to Israel, which of course is an apartheid state and is a country that's occupying the land of another people. It's been estimated that diamonds bring about 1 billion euros per year to the Israeli war and occupation industry. A few years ago, you might recall, Belgium had a non-elected prime minister called Yves Leterme, who visited Tel Aviv, and he cited estimates that the diamond trade between Belgium and Israel is worth about 2 billion euros per year, if memory serves me correctly. So that indicates actually that the diamond trade alone is one of the most important aspects of the entire economic relationship between the European Union and Israel. So I think that this is something really that people in Belgium should be much more concerned about and much more active on than they have been to date. And I think it's something that really has to be properly investigated.
They defend the policy by stating that it's giving work to 6,000 people, the diamond business in Antwerp. To which extent that is true, I don't know.
But I've no doubt that the diamond trade is of importance to the local economy here in Antwerp. I don't dispute that for a second. But unfortunately, the argument about jobs is used to justify all kinds of policies, you know, that simply cannot be justified. So I don't have figures for precisely how many jobs the trade between Belgium and Israel brings, but I would suspect that it's not massive, number one. And in any event, you know, unfortunately those jobs are unethical jobs. In any event, I don't think the jobs argument can be used to justify support for an apartheid state. It was used, of course, in the case of Europe's support for apartheid South Africa in the 1980s and even earlier, but it was a morally bankrupt argument. And, if that argument has been used to defend the diamond trade between Israel and Antwerp, unfortunately, I believe it's also a morally bankrupt argument. That's not to say that I want to see people made unemployed in the Antwerp Diamond District. Of course, that's not what I'm arguing. But, I do think there are always alternative ways. Politicians will often claim, and they will often quote Margaret Thatcher's famous maxim, you know, that there's no alternative to certain policies, that neoliberalism in her case. But there are always alternatives. There are always alternative sources of investment. If politicians are willing to look for alternatives, they'll find them.
Okay.
Thanks very much.
Okay, thank you for coming to Antwerp.
Pleasure.